When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurdy burn is done.
When the battle's lost and won. That will be at a set of sun. Where the place
upon the heath.
There to meet with Macbeth.
And what could be more appropriate for the Halloween season than the three witches from Macbeth bending over their bubbling cauldrons? Welcome again to Anthology. This is Fleetwood. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the Poetry Center of the Young Men and Young Women's Hebrew Association in New York, brings you Anthology, a selection of readings from poets, past and present, and the music to accompany their poetry. Our guests today, by transcription, Wallace House, Alec Guinness, with the members of London's famed Old Vic Company. Staring owl her note has sung, with gaping snakes my cave is hung. Of maiden hair my bed is made, two winding sheets above it laid. With bones of men my shelves are piled, and toads are for my supper biled. Three ghosts attend to fill my cup, and four to serve my porridge up. The crow is waiting to say grace. Wouldst thou in such a dismal place the secrets of thy fortune trace? Finding poetic material suitable for the Halloween season proved to be an easy job, since ghosts, ghouls, witches, and the like have been a favorite subject of poets down through the centuries. Originally known as All Hallows' Eve, Halloween is derived from the rites of the Druids celebrating the day of Samhain, when the Lord of Death called together the souls of the wicked who had died during the year. Since the season abounds with eerie sights and sounds, we've lined up an imposing list of poetic shockers for this edition of an anthology. For instance, let's begin with that typically Halloweenish character, the ghost. The minute anyone says ghost to me, a silly little doggerel flashes through my mind. I haven't the least idea where or when I heard it, and I may even be misquoting, but I think it goes, "I saw a ghost upon the stair. He wasn't there. He wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Gee, how I wish he'd go away." Ring any bells with you? Well, let's listen to the story of another sort of ghost, one with a British accent. Enter Mr. Wallace House to entertain you with the saga of Albert Ramsbottom and the Eddsman.
On young Albert Ramsbottom's birthday, his parents asked what he'd like most. He said, "See the Tower of London and gaze upon Anne Boleyn's ghost." They thought this request were unusual, and at first to refuse were inclined, till Pa said, "A trip to Metrollops might broaden the little lad's mind." They took Cherry Bank up to London and got there at 4:45. Then, seeing as pubs wasn't open, they went straight away to the Tower. They didn't think much to the building. Went what they'd been led to suppose, and the bad word tower didn't impress them. They said Blackpool had got one of those. At last Albert found a beefeater and filled the old chap with alarm by asking for ghost of Anne Boleyn, as carried her head neath her arm. Said beefeater, "You ought to come Fridays if it's ghost of Anne Boleyn you seek. Her union now limits her output, and she only gets one walk a week. But he said if it's ghosts that you're after, there's Lady Jane Grace to be seen. She runs around chased by the headsman at midnight on Old Tower Green. They waited onto Green till near midnight, then thinking they'd time for a soap, they took out what food they'd brought with them and waited for the ghost to turn up. At the first stroke of 12, up jumped Albert, his mouth full of cold, dripping toast. With his stick with the horse's head handle, he pointed and said,
"Here's the ghost."
They felt their skins going all goosey as Lady Jane's spectre drew near, and Albert fair swallowed his tonsils when the headsman and all did appear. The headsman chased Jane round the grass patch. They saw his axe flash in the moon, and seeing his poor lass were headless, they wondered what next he would prune. He suddenly caught sight of Albert as midnight was on its last chime. As he lifted his axe, Father murmured, "We'll get the insurance this time." At that, Mother Rose, taking umbrage, she said, "Put that cleaver away. You're not cutting our Albert's head off. Yon collar we're clean on today." The brave little lad stood undaunted till the ghosts were within half a pace. Then taking the toast he were eating, slapped it, dripping side down, in his face. 'Twere a proper setback for the headsman. He let out one howl of despair. Then taking his lady friend with him, he disappeared, just like that there. When Pa saw the way as they vanished, he trembled with fear and looked blue, till Ma went and patted his shoulder and said, "It's all right, lad. We saw it too. Some say 'twere the dripping as done it. From a roast leg of mutton it came. And as the headsman had been a beef eater, they reckon he vanished from shame. And around Tower Green from that moment, they've never seen sign of a ghost. But when the beef eaters go on night duty, they take slices of cold, dripping toast."
In addition to ghosts, goblins are standard Halloween fare. They come in all shapes and sizes, ranging from the little girl next door in her mother's best bed linen to the type described by James Whitcomb Riley in one of the most familiar of all children's poems. We thought you might enjoy Little Orphaned Annie. Little Orphaned Annie's come to our house to stay and wash the cups and saucers up and brush the crumbs away and shoo the chickens off the porch and dust the hearth and sweep and make the fire and bake the bread and earn her board and keep. And all us other children, when the supper things is done, we sit around the kitchen fire and has the mostest fun a-listening to the witch tales that Annie tells about and the goblins that gets you if you don't watch out. Once there was a little boy wouldn't say his prayers, and when he went to bed at night, way upstairs, his mammy heard him holler, and his daddy heard him bawl, and when they turned the kivers back, he wasn't there at all. And they seeked him in the rafter room and cubbyhole and press, and seeked him up the chimney flue, and everywhere, I guess. But all they ever found was just his pants and roundabout. And the goblins'll get you if you don't watch out. And one time a little girl would always laugh and grin and make fun of everyone and all her blood and kin. And once, when they was company, and old folks that was there, she mocked them and shocked them and said she didn't care. And just as she kicked her heels and turned to run and hide, there was two great big black things a-standing by her side, and they snatched her through the ceiling before she knowed what she's about. And the goblins'll get you if you don't watch out. And little Orphaned Annie says, when the blaze is blue and the lampwick sputters and the wind goes woo, and you hear the crickets quit and the moon is gray and the lightning bugs in dew is all squenched away, you better mind your parents and your teachers fond and dear and cherish them that loves you and dry the orphan's tear and help the poor and needy ones that clusters all about. Or the goblins will get you if you don't watch out. Yes, the goblins will get you if you don't watch out. Now, let's see. What else is standard equipment for the Halloween season? Well, games, bobbing for apples for the kids. I heard a sophisticated variation on that game the other day. In one of the smarter East Side bistros, which liberally dot Manhattan, someone suggested that on Halloween Eve, it might be fun to fill the laundry tub with martinis and bob for olives. Pink elephants, anyone? A very highly improbable zoo could undoubtedly be started if you were able to trap some of the Halloween-type animals which race through the pages of the poets who lean toward the macabre and fantastic. Edgar Allan Poe's Raven might be a start, or William Rose Benet's Unicorn. In fact, the poem is called How to Catch Unicorns and ends with this two-line addendum. Really hungry? Good Lord, deliver us. The unicorn is not carnivorous. I have another favorite animal, or maybe I should qualify that, because Archie is an insect, a cockroach to be exact. His career is told at length in a fantastically funny book by Don Marquis entitled The Lives and Times of Archie and Mehitabel, published by Doubleday and Company. As I explained, Archie is a cockroach who used to sneak in at night and use Don Marquis' typewriter while the columnist was out gathering material. There are no capital letters or punctuation in any of Archie's classic poetry, which is understandable when you consider the fact that he had to jump from key to operate the machine. I'd like to read one of Don Marquis' most imaginative Archie poems. This one is called Ghosts, with a small g, naturally. Archie is speaking. Go on, Archie. He's a little mic conscious. Go on. I'll give you the first line of the poem. You want to know...
You want to know whether I believe in ghosts? Of course I do not believe in them. If you had known as many of them as I have, you would not believe in them either. Perhaps I have been unfortunate in my acquaintance, but the ones I have known have been a bad lot. No one could believe in them after being acquainted with them a short time. It is true that I have met them under peculiar circumstances. That is, while they were migrating into the bodies of what human beings consider the lower order of creatures. Before I became a cockroach, I was a free verse poet, one of the pioneers of the artless art. And my punishment for that was to have my soul enter the body of a cockroach. The ghosts I have known were the ghosts of persons who were waiting for a vacant body to get into. They knew they were going to transmigrate into the bodies of lizards, beetles, mice, alley cats, turtles, snails, tadpoles, etc. And while they were waiting, they were as cross as all get out. I remember talking to one of them who had just worked his way upwards again. He had been in the body of a flea, and he was going into a catfish. You would think he might be grateful for the promotion, but not he. I do not call this much of an advance, he said. Why could I not be a hummingbird or something? Kid, I told him, it will take you a million years to work your way up to a hummingbird. When I remember, he said, that I used to be a hat check boy in a hotel, I could spend a million years weeping. To think that I should come to this. We have all seen better days, I said. We have all come down in the world. You have not come down as far as some of us. If I ever get to be a hat check boy again, he said, I will sting somebody for what I have had to suffer. That remark will probably cost you another million years among the lower creatures, I told him. Transmigration is a great thing if you don't weaken. Personally, my ambition is to get my time as a cockroach shortened for good behavior and be promoted to a revenue officer. It is not much of a step up, but I am humble. I never ran across any of this ectoplasm that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle tells of, but it sounds as if it might be wonderful stuff to mend broken furniture with. Archie.
Ghosts by Don Marquis. If you'd like to read all about Archie's wonderfully zany adventures, pick up a copy of The Life and Times of Archie and Mehitabel. The publisher is Doubleday and Company. It was nice having you on Anthology, Archie.
The pleasure was all mine, Fleetwood. Wow, look at that thunderstorm coming up. I'm going back into the wall.
Shall we three meet again in thunder, lightning, or in rain?
When the hurdy burns down, when the battle's lost.
No self-respecting program for the Halloween season would be complete without a plentiful supply of witches. And we have three of the most famous witches in poetic drama. They appear and disappear at will, as you know, in Shakespeare's towering tragedy of Macbeth. Today, we'll not only hear their dire predictions, but follow said predictions through to their ultimate conclusion. Our production stars Alec Guinness as Macbeth, Pamela Brown as Lady Macbeth, with members of the famed Old Vic Company of London. Written about 1606, the play is the drama of the gradual ruin of a man who yields to evil within and evil without. His first crime, carefully plotted for him by Lady Macbeth, is the murder of Duncan, which is only a stepping stone to later acts of violence. Duncan dies, and Banquo. And in Act 4, Macbeth returns to the Cave of the Witches, hoping they will be able to foretell more of the future for him. Look, there they stand behind the bubbling cauldrons, hideous, cackling as they stir their magic broth and mutter evil incantations.
Fool it with a bubble's blood, then the charm is firm and good. By the pricking of my thumbs, something wicked this way comes. Open locks, whoever knocks.
Oh no, you secret black and midnight hags. What is to do?
A deed without a name.
I come to you by that which you profess, however you come to know it. Answer me to what I ask you.
Speak, Dimmer. We'll answer. Say, if thou'dst rather hear it from our mouths or from our master.
All of them, let me see them.
Pouring sow's blood that hath eaten her nine fathom. Grease that's sweating from the murderer's gibbet. Throw into the flame. Come high or low, thyself and off this deathly show.
Tell me, thou unknown power.
He knows thy thought. Hear his speech, but say thou not.
Macbeth, 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 beware Macduff. Beware the fame of fight. Dismiss me, enough.
Well, there thou art for thy good caution, thanks. Thou hast harped my fear aright. But one word more.
He will not be commanded. Here's another, more potent than the first.
Macbeth! Macbeth! Macbeth!
And I 3 years I'd hear thee.
Be bloody, bold, and resolute. Laugh to scorn the power of man. For none of woman born shall harm Macbeth.
Then live, Macduff! What need I fear of thee? But yet I'll make assurance double sure, and take a bond of fate. Thou shalt not live, that I may tell pale-hearted fear it lies, and sleep in spite of thunder. What is this that rises like the issue of a king, and wears upon his baby brow the round and top of sovereignty?
Listen, but speak not to it.
Shall never vanquish thee until great Birnam Wood to hide on Thynane Hill shall come against him.
That will never be. Who can impress the forest, bid the tree unfix his earthbound root? Yet my heart throbs to know one thing. Tell me if your art can tell so much. Shall Banquo's issue ever reign in this kingdom?
Seek to know no more.
I will be satisfied. Deny me this, and an eternal curse fall on you. Let me know.
Show. Show his eyes and weave his heart. Come like shadows, so depart.
Macbeth,
thou art too like the spirit of Banquo. Down. Thy crown, the seer, mine eyeballs.
Macbeth.
And thy hair, thou other gold-bound brow, is like the first. A third is like the former.
Macbeth.
Filthy hags, why do you show me this?
Macbeth.
Oh,
start
I.
Macbeth.
Forward will the line stretch out to the crack of doom.
Macbeth.
Another yet.
Macbeth.
The seventh, I'll see no more.
Macbeth.
And yet the eighth appears, who bears a glass which shows me many more. And some I see the twofold balls and treble scepters carry. Horrible sight!
Macbeth.
Now I see it is true. For the blood-bolted Banquo smiles upon me and points at them for his. What is this so?
Macbeth, 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 Macbeth.
Macbeth's bloody trail leads from the Cave of the Witches toward the final scenes of the play, when he and his queen must pay for their crimes of overambition. Lady Macbeth's mind cracks under the strain of the terrors she has known, the horror she has caused, and she is given at night to walking the passages of the castle in her sleep. On this particular night, there are observers waiting in a darkened corner by the stairs where she will descend.
Lulu, here she comes. This is her very guise, upon my life, fast asleep. Observe her. Stand close.
How came she by that taper?
Why, it stood by her. She has light by her continually. It is her command.
You see, her eyes are open.
Aye, but their sense is shut.
What is it she does now? Look how she rubs her hands.
It is an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I have known her continuing this a quarter of an hour.
Yet here's a spot.
Hark, she speaks. I will set down what comes from her to satisfy my remembrance the more strongly.
Out, damned spot, out, I say. One, two, why then, 'tis time to do it. Hell is murky. If I'm a lord, fire, soldier, and a feared, what need we fear? Who knows it when none can call our power to account? Yet who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him?
Do you mark that?
The Thane of Fife had a wife. Where is she now? What will these hands ne'er be clean? No more of that, my lord, no more of that. You mar all with this starting.
Go to, you have known what you should not.
She has spoke what she should not, I am sure of that. Heaven knows what she has known.
Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand.
What a sigh is there, the heart is sorely charged.
I would not have such a heart in my bosom for the dignity of the whole body.
Wash your hands, put on your nightgown, look not so pale. I tell you yet again, Banquo's buried. He cannot come out on his grave.
Even so.
To bed. To bed, there's knocking at the gate. Come, 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 give me your hand. What's done cannot be undone. To bed.
The queen dies by her own hand. Burnham Wood moves to Dunsinane as predicted by the three witches. And now their final prophecy comes true as Macbeth faces Duncan in the stormy battle scenes which climax this great Shakespearean drama.
Beast slain, and with no stroke of mine, my wife and children's ghosts will haunt me still. I cannot strike at wretched kerns whose arms are hired to bear their staves. Either thou, Macbeth, or else my sword with an unbattered edge I sheathe again undeeded. There thou shouldst be, by this great clatter one of greatest note seems bruited. Let me find him, fortune, and more I beg not. Tied me to a stake, I cannot fly. But bear-like I must fight the course. What's he that was not born of woman? Such a one am I to fear or none. Turn, hellhound, turn! Of all men else I have avoided thee. I'll get thee back. My soul is too much charged with blood of thine already.
I have no words. My voice is in my sword, thou bloodier villain than terms can give thee out.
Thou losest labor, as easy mayest thou the entrenched air with thy keen sword impress as make me bleed. Let fall thy blade on vulnerable crests. I bear a charmed life, which must not yield to one of woman born.
Despair thy charm, and let the angel whom thou still hast served tell thee Macduff was from his mother's womb untimely ripped.
Accursed be the tongue that tells me so.
for it hath cowed my better part of man. And be these juggling fiends no more believed, that palter with us in a double sense, that keep the word of promise to our ear, and break it to our hope. I'll not fight with thee.
Then yield thee, coward, and lift a bit of show and gaze of the time. We'll have thee as our rarer monsters are, painted upon a pole, and under it, here you may see the time.
I will not yield to kiss the ground before young Malcolm's feet, and to be baited with the rabble's curse. Though Burnham would be come to Dunsinane, and thou opposed, being of no woman born, yet I will try the last. Before my body I throw my warlike shield. Lay on, Macduff, and damned be him that first cries, hold enough!
Hail, Malcolm, King of Scotland! See where stands the usurper's cursed head. The time is free. I see thee compassed with thy kingdom's pearl that speak my salutation in their minds, whose voices I desire aloud with mine. Hail, King of Scotland!
Hail, King of Scotland! Hail, King of Scotland! Hail, King of Scotland!
Well, we hope you weren't too frightened by our Halloween poetry or the excerpts from the RCA Victor LP album of Macbeth. Just in case you might be a little uneasy, a few lines which were whispered by Scottish mothers to their babies during just such a season as this. From ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night, may the good Lord protect you. Next week on Anthology, the story behind the famous Cadman Records, related by Barbara Cohen and Marion Roney, the company owners, with excerpts from the latest Cadman albums featuring Alfred Drake, Basil Rathbone, and William Faulkner. Anthology is brought to you, transcribed, in conjunction with the Poetry Center of the YM and YWHA in New York. This has been an NBC radio production, written and directed by Draper Lewis. Until next week, this is Fleetwood wishing you goodbye and good reading.